This is Statehouse Watch on WNHN. LP 94.7 in Concord. I'm Arnie Alpert.
I'm Maggie Fogarty, and we are here from the American Friends Service Committee New Hampshire program, as we are every Monday during the legislative session, bringing you State House Watch Radio.
Repeated on Tuesdays from 8 to 9 a.m. and repeated all the time by podcast at WNHNFM.org. Just go there and look at all the programs that are here.
Yeah, there's a lot of good stuff.
Reasons to listen to this station at times other than 5 to 6 and 8 to 9 on Mondays and Tuesday mornings. But you can find recordings of all of our past shows. And if you dip into the archives, you can actually find recordings of shows from last year and the year before that and the year before that. And I believe the year before that. Because this is, Maggie, our 8th season doing this show.
That's flown by.
Isn't that cool?
Well, and remind people what show was last week.
Last week, we actually had a special show for Martin Luther King Day because we were away celebrating Martin Luther King Day. So we did a pre-recorded show, which included a few interviews with local celebrities. We had Senator Melanie Levesque and Representative Linda Harriet Gathright. We had Reverend Jason Wells and we had Martin Toe, our colleague, all talking about the significance of Martin Luther King Day. We replayed a very interesting talk, a speech given by Coretta Scott King at Resurrection City during the Poor People's Campaign occupation of Washington on the Mall in May of 1968, where she talked about poverty, she talked about violence, she talked about the war the United States was waging in Vietnam during that period of time.
And she talked about the many different kinds of violence that we are called upon to transform into peace and real security for people.
It's a very interesting speech. We had an excerpt from Dr. King's Nobel Prize acceptance speech, which I thought was always appropriate. I mean, whenever I listen to that, it seems timely. Mm. And we had a number of great songs, too. So it was a good thing. And you can go and listen to that podcast of that show on the air. And it's even if it's not Martin Luther King Day, you can listen to it.
Well, thank you for pre-recording it, because all of those people you just named, except for Coretta and Dr. King, were busily running around to all sorts of events around the state. So we got to be together, I think, with everybody you just named at the Nashua celebration put on by the Outreach for Black Unity, where you were the keynote. Yeah. And I will tell you, you did a marvelous address.
Oh, thank you.
And I really appreciate it. I learned something new each time. But just hearing the history of the campaign to create Martin Luther King Day in the context of the voices, some of which were coming from the pages of the Union Leader, that remind us that this was a period of hostility to the idea of racial justice and civil rights and to Dr. King and his legacy. And I think people were really startled to hear some of the quotes that you lifted up from those times. So
it was very, some interesting history and stories. But it's a story of people who decided that this holiday was important, and they kept it up. And we kept up that campaign for 20 years until it finally passed. So it was good to see Senator Shaheen out talking about it. It was interesting to see in Senator Shaheen's weekly message that she sends to constituents, she talked about being proud of her role in the signing of the Martin Luther King holiday and being able to participate in recognizing the 20th anniversary of the first Martin Luther King Day in the state.
Oh, very good.
So that was kind of cool, too.
Very good.
And Senator Levesque also talked about actually, it was interesting. Senator Levesque sent out a message to her supporters a couple days ago, and she mentioned coming by the American Friends Service Committee office to record an interview for Statehouse Watch and had a link to the podcast of the show. So that was also kind of cool to see.
Great. So I was also glad Governor Sununu was on the dais in Nashua, not because I benefited really from anything that he had to say, but the contrast between his sense of what the message was for that day was quite sharp with your message of coming together for collective action for the common good, including a meaningful role for government policies and investments. And his message was quite the opposite of that at many points.
Well, so it's perhaps a longer conversation, Maggie, but it's also interesting just to see, again, the different elements of Dr. King that different people identify with. And that's really one of the reasons why ultimately we were able to get the holiday accepted, because so many different people found something in Dr. King that they said, yes, this is important
feels
to us
like
as
truth.
A people now that we need to lift up. And it's my hope, and I hope I got into that in the talks that I gave last weekend, that we spend some time actually digging into who Dr. King was and what he stood for, what he wrote, what he believed, what he advocated, and how he lived, because it's in those meanings that we can draw some conclusions that can help us deal with the persistence of racism and poverty and violence and war, and think about how do we engage in processes of bringing about change to end those evils and bring about a just and democratic society.
That's right. And people who were able to attend the Manchester celebration, which I think of as the mothership for MLK celebrations in New Hampshire. Was it the 38th year of
celebration? This was the 38th year.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. So folks who were at that, it was very well attended, heard a panel discussion of representatives from different aspects of the Poor People's Campaign. And I thought they gave a very effective voice to the intersectionality of these issues of how climate crisis is related to militarism, how militarism is related to classism, how all of it connects with racism, and then that the solutions are intersectional as well.
Interesting. One of the people that we heard from was Representative Wendy Thomas from Merrimack, who identified herself as a water warrior and talking about the pollution of her community's water supply by a corporation. And we'll actually be able to talk later on this show with Representative Rennie Cushing from Hampton, who has also been active in the effort to try to protect New Hampshire's water from PFAS. And maybe he can even tell us what PFAS stands for, because I'm not going to bother.
Yeah,
so anyway,
very good.
Polyfluoroalkyl something or other. Anyway, so we'll leave that.
He's grumbling in the background.
We'll leave that for later. He's got a couple minutes to look it up if he wants to. So anyway, all right. Anyway, but this is State House Watch on WNHN-LP. I'm Arnie Alpert.
I'm Maggie Fogarty. Yeah. This is 94.7 FM.
Yeah.
So let's talk about the minimum wage movement that's happening in the legislature this year. Voices of Faith will be at the doors of the Senate chambers on Thursday in support of SB 410. Do you want to just put that in context?
And also Raise Up New Hampshire, the New Hampshire Alliance for Moral Economy, will be there as well, bringing together people from groups including Rights and Democracy and the State Employees Union and the Grand State Organizing Project and the United Church of Christ and others to try to be saying that New Hampshire needs to be moving towards laws that enable workers in the state to get a living wage for the labor that they do.
So tell us about the Senator Susie's bill.
Senator Susie's bill, it's SB 410, and this is, I think she said, the eighth year in a row that she has introduced legislation to try to reestablish the state's authority to set a minimum wage and then to raise it. So this would raise it in two steps to $10 an hour next year and then $12 an hour in 2023. There's also a House bill that we're following, sponsored by Representative Chris Schultz, who was a guest here in the studio a few weeks ago, that would raise the minimum wage in five steps, I believe, and get it up to $15 by 2025. And because Representative Schultz's bill will cross over to the Senate, you know, there will ultimately be a process of reconciliation between the two bodies, we expect. And we'll be trying to push for whatever is the most ambitious minimum wage legislation that we can get.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, in the House, we heard someone say that the minimum wage is actually only for no-skilled workers, which a lot of people found to be offensive. In the Senate public hearing, we heard a business lobbyist say that the minimum wage was never intended to be something that would enable people to earn a living wage, but is primarily for training purposes. And again, there's no—
What a convenient misinformation.
Yeah, there's no historical basis for that.
No.
So anyway, but I want to play a little, give a little sense of what actually happened in the public hearing in the Senate Commerce Committee a couple of weeks ago. So first we're going to hear from Senator Donna Susie, and then we'll hear some other voices.
Great.
In the time since Governor Sununu vetoed my last effort to gradually raise New Hampshire's minimum wage to $12 an hour, we've seen every neighboring state increase their wage. It's high time that New Hampshire get with the rest of our neighboring states. It's high time that New Hampshire set a wage that is appropriate for New Hampshire people and not cede that authority to the federal government. It's high time that New Hampshire reestablish and increase its own minimum wage.
For the record, my name is Viola Kamsime, and I'm testifying today on behalf of the Grand State Organizing Project. So back in 1938, when the wage was established as part of the Fair Labor Standards Act, its intent was to make sure that all work would be awarded fairly and the regular employment would provide a decent quality of life. But over the decades, the minimum wage has lost value due to inflation. At the same time, productivity has increased while compensation for workers has stayed the same, meaning that workers' purchasing power has been reduced. This has meant that low-wage workers have to work long hours or even get two or three jobs to attain basic needs.
Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Kathy Staff. I live in Manchester, and I'm part of an organization called Race Up New Hampshire. Well, let's face it, $7.25 is a starvation wage. Also, I'd like to say that in terms of attracting workers or letting people know how the state of New Hampshire views its working population, having that $7.25 minimum wage is like hanging the sign up that says, we don't value workers.
Chair calls Amanda Sears.
I'm the director of the Campaign for a Family-Friendly Economy. 60% of Republic assistance funds are going to working families. If we raise our wages, our bottom wages, we can help to reduce the amount of those families who need to rely on public assistance funds.
All good points. Yeah, sounds like strong testimony.
And there was also, I mean, I actually spoke, as I tend to do in those hearings, about the cost of housing in New Hampshire. I brought some historic data and gave that to the committee, and again, talking about how many minimum wage jobs would be necessary in order to be able to afford a sort of regular standard apartment in New Hampshire. I think it's like 3.6 minimum wage jobs at 7.25 would be needed. And even at $15 an hour, really a worker can't afford just a regular, typical apartment in New Hampshire.
Right.
So.
Right.
And of course, the cost of housing. Even if we get the minimum wage back, and that goes up in steps over the next few years, that doesn't restrain the cost of housing from going up. So it's.
That's right. We need a holistic approach remedies here for housing security and. Yeah. The Senate Commerce Committee went on to approve SB 410 by a vote of 3-2. Was that a party line?
I assume it was. Yeah.
And that's what's in front of the Senate then on Thursday January 30.
And it's the first bill on the calendar.
Okay.
So we'll be there right at the beginning, and that'll keep going.
Yeah. So please join Raise Up New Hampshire, join Voices of Faith, and sit in the gallery, too, and watch that happen.
That's good. You know, it's one of the interests. There's a lot of – obviously, when you have 400 legislators and 24 senators, you end up with a diversity of proposals come before the legislature. So this year, one of the interesting ones is coming from our studio guest, Representative Rennie Cushing, that has to do with the exoneration of people who were – convicted of crimes associated with the Red Scare of the 1950s and the witch hunts of hundreds of years ago.
Mm-hmm.
So before, to kind of get us in the right mood, I want to play a song written by someone. We all know songs like Somewhere Over the Rainbow, written by a guy named Yip Harburg. I bet very few of our listeners, Maggie, know that Yip Harburg himself was red-baited and blacklisted during the McCarthy period, suspected of being a subversive or knowing subversives or knowing people who knew subversives. And also he ended up having a career that suffered. And this recording that we're going to play of one of his most famous songs, Brother, Can You Spare a Dime, is interesting in part because it's performed by the Weavers, who were blacklisted during the 1950s. So this is particularly the voice of Fred Hellerman from the Weavers that we'll hear.
They used to tell me I was building a dream, and so I followed the mob. When there was earth to plow or guns to bear, I was always there, right there on the job. They used to tell me I was building a dream with peace and glory ahead. Why should I be standing in line, just waiting for bread? Once I built a railroad, made it run, made it race against time. Once I built a railroad, now it's done. Brother, can you spare a dime? Once I built a tower to the sun, made of brick and rivet and lime. Once I built a tower, now it's done. Brother, can you spare a dime? once in khaki suits. Gee, we looked swell, full of that Yankee doodly-dum. Half a million boots went slogging through hell, and I was the guy with the drum. Say, don't you remember, they called me Al. It was Al all the time. Say, don't you remember, I'm your pal. Buddy, can you spare a dime?
Brother, Can You Spare a Dime, performed by the Weavers, sung by Fred Heller. And this is Statehouse Watch.
Wow. That was a beautiful selection, Arnie.
Yeah.
It makes me think that it might be worthwhile doing a whole show on songs about the Red Scare, songs by artists who were targeted in that time.
Or maybe we can just keep that as a little sub-theme here as we go forward for
the
rest
interludes.
Of the season this year.
Yeah,
that's right.
So you are listening to Statehouse Watch Radio on 94.7 FM with Maggie and Arnie. And we're joined in the studio today by our friend and colleague, State Representative Rennie Cushing, in his seventh term in the legislature and current chairman of the House Criminal Justice and Public Safety Committee. Welcome, Rennie.
Thanks. It's great to be here. Yeah.
So let's jump right in and talk about this bill that relates to the exoneration of Willard Uphaus. What does the bill do, and why are you interested in doing it?
Well, I think what the bill does is it establishes a process to correct historic injustices, and it lifts two examples of instances where individuals were persecuted, were jailed, and through the lens of history, we can see how manifestly injustice that is. And those two people are Goody Cole, Eunice Cole, who was the only person convicted of witchcraft in the history of the state of New Hampshire. She was from Hampton, and Hampton's my hometown, so I grew up understanding, at least hearing about the legacy of Goody Cole, although it was kind of a caricature, you know, which is
like a threat, sort of like, don't be like
Goody Cole. I say the first witch I ever saw was the one that Dorothy's house fell on on her way from Kansas to Munchkin Land, and grew up where, you know, the witch I knew was bewitched on television. But I came to understand what persecution Eunice Cole went through. You know, from 1950s, 60s, and 70s, she was someone accused of witchcraft. She was flogged. She was jailed. She was put in stockade. She was treated horribly and was a victim of kind of intolerance that was manifest. You know, she was she was accused of being familiar with the devil, with familiar with cats, with children would fall ill, and it was said that Goody Cole was the person responsible for it. So I've always been concerned about that injustice and how we don't really realize what was taking place when we, you know, use it as a nickname for a restaurant or something like that.
Right.
It's really.
And what about her triggered that kind of hostility and violence? Was she someone dedicated to kind of an earth-focused spirituality?
No,
was she?
Goody Cole came to North America as an indentured servant. She landed in Exeter and then moved to Hampton in the early days of the settlement. She was somebody who married a man who was substantially older than her, about 30 years, and that in and of itself was somewhat suspect. She had no children, which of course made her suspect.
Yeah.
She had some property that she lost when she was in jail in she was convicted of, familiarity with the devil, was imprisoned, lost her property, became a ward, and came back time and again. There were accusations made about her for things that were – anything that mysterious happened. There was people allegedly spied.
She was scapegoated.
She was scapegoated. And I think part of it was like just because of it, indifferent. People castigated her for being unfriendly. But I think if we look back in the early colonial periods, we see other examples of intolerance. Not, I think of witches certainly, but I also think of the persecution of the Quakers.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Goody Cole is somebody who's her putting in the stockade and being flogging was a you know, precursor to when the three Quaker women from Dover were marched in whipped in each community. And it's just a manifest injustice. The other one is Willard Uphouse. And for people who are not familiar with
Willard.
Yes,
good. Tell his story.
He was the director of a kind of a magical place. In,
that's still magical.
That's still magical place in the 1950s. He was the director of the World Fellowship Center, which was a place famously known for being open to all races, colors, and creeds. Back in the day when the White Mountains really meant the White Mountains, this was a place where interracial couples and people of color were welcome and could find safe haven. And it also sponsored a series of, you know, talks by guests who would be at this resort. And in the 1950s, the New Hampshire legislature, in lockstep with the McCarthyism or the period of intolerance of the times, established a one-man committee to look into subversive activity in the state of New Hampshire. And it was headed up by then Attorney General Louis Wyman. Mm-hmm. And there was a story that appeared in the Manchester Union Leader one day that was considered an expose of who was at the World Fellowship Center. It was the pinpointed. That's where the communists were in New Hampshire.
With the headline running was something like pro-red propagandist takes over New Hampshire Fellowship Center.
Wow.
And so, you know, Willard Uphouse came down to Concord from Albany and met with the Attorney General, was willing to have a conversation with him about what a wonderful place the World Fellowship Center was.
I'm sure he invited him to come.
Yeah. He declined. And, you know, there was an investigation. The state of New Hampshire decided to have an undercover agent take over, spend the summer at the World Fellowship Center so they could track down Reds. Willard Uphouse was summoned to Concord and to surrender the list of guests at the Fellowship Center and the list of employees so that Louis Wyman would be able to publish their names and make it – the standard determination often was unable to come to a conclusion whether they were guilty or not.
Wow.
And it was simply –
So just let
them,
that hang in the air.
And Willard Uphouse was a man of principle who refused to betray people. He was he was a pacifist. He was a fascinating man, was a Quaker born in the Midwest – helped integrate the Yale Divinity School in the 19s, went on to work with the Religion and Labor Foundation, and he always tried to stand with working people. And I had the chance to meet Willard in the 1970s at the World Fellowship Center. And as a child of New Hampshire, I didn't have a real consciousness of what was going on, but as, again, trying to uncover our lost history, I came to realize how important it was that somebody stood up to that reign of terror that was taking place, and
yes.
and Willard was that victim of a witch hunt, and so, a few years ago,
we should mention what happened though, Rennie, because since he refused to turn over the guest list, the Attorney General went to court for an injunction ordering him to do so, and when he contested the injunction, the case went all the way up to the United States Supreme Court, which ultimately ruled that it was a lawful injunction. By the time that happened, Maggie, the whole McCarthy period was considered an embarrassment to the country. But New Hampshire was still in it, and Louis Wyman was still the Attorney General, and he still wanted that list. So it was till 1959 that the case gets remanded back to Merrimack County Superior Court, and Judge Grant says one more time, Dr. Uphouse, will you turn over the list? And Willard one more time says no. And Willard Uphouse gets sent to jail.
To the Boscawen jail, right?
Yeah. The Boscawen jail. He, celebrated his 70th birthday behind bars.
Oh, my.
And New Hampshire had a tremendous amount of notoriety, I think, and it wasn't all good, about the treatment of this elderly pacifist. Several years ago.
And he served a full year.
He served a year in jail and get out. It's interesting. No less a personage than he was represented by a man, Judge Hugh Bounds. A person went on, Hugh Bounds went on to be a federal district court judge. When Judge Bounds passed away several years ago, he was eulogized at the memorial service by former Chief Justice David Souter, who knew him. They served together. And Justice Souter acknowledged that what many people knew, that there was really no basis for the conviction of Willard Uphouse, that there was no evidence of any subversive activities, and that Judge Bounds had done what a good lawyer would do, and that stand on the side of the people who are being persecuted.
Wow.
Yeah. Rennie, I find it a little ironic right now that we're looking to the memory of Willard Uphouse, a man who was persecuted for refusing to turn over documents that the state had asked for. At the same time, in Washington, we have an impeachment trial going on for a president, in part for obstructing Congress by refusing to turn over documents or produce witnesses that Congress is interested in. So I'm curious about the kind of juxtaposition of Donald J. Trump and Dr. Willard Uphouse in terms of two people refusing to go along with the state.
That's fascinating, along with the juxtaposition between Donald Trump and Goody Cole, who was a victim of what a real witch hunt was, and someone
point.
Who asserts that they
who
are
a victim of a witch hunt. Yeah.
And not knowing that it was the full weight of government and of society that came down upon Goody Cole because she was weak, because she was an outcast, because she was different.
Because she was a woman.
It was a woman. And, you know, in an era where we're trying to understand what tolerance and what inclusion is, the difference between Goody Cole and Donald Trump is manifest, as is the difference between the situation with Willard Uphouse and Donald Trump.
Yes, one of the key differences being who has power, who has principles here, and who is merely self-serving.
Well, another thing that I think is an interesting difference is that Willard understood the tradition of civil disobedience and talked about in his memoir. He writes about looking out over the Merrimack River flowing by and thinking about the river as a place where Henry David Thoreau used to canoe. And he's in the jail reading on the duty of civil disobedience by Thoreau. And of course, you know, part of Thoreau's point is that when you refuse to do the bidding of the state and you face punishment for it, that can be redemptive, that can lead to change. And Willard was operating in that tradition, whereas I believe that right now President Trump is acting in a different tradition, just trying to
– Of dictators.
Yeah, just trying to refuse to be accountable for his actions rather than being willing to be accountable for his actions, even if it leads to some type of personal discomfort or suffering.
Yeah.
I got to know a little of Willard in the 1970s when I – being involved in resistance to the construction of the Seabrook Atomic Plant with Arnie and a number of people, where in the Public Service Company of New Hampshire got an ex parte injunction that basically prohibited anybody from entering – having bad thoughts or entering upon the property that they owned in Seabrook, and was found in contempt of court for violating
You were found in contempt.
I was found and summarily sentenced to 6 months in jail. And during the course of some legal wranglings that took place in the aftermath of it, very prominent was the case of Willard Uphouse for contempt of court that figured in the background. And it was coming to understand what it was like with the power of the court coming down upon people that I, you know, it was something I actually had a conversation with Willard about.
Wow, fascinating. And did you have to serve that sentence?
I served a short period of time. It's a couple of weeks, and then we were
– My.
Then there was the federal court in Boston found that we were entitled to have a judge who was impartial. The case was dismissed.
So I could talk about this and ask a thousand questions, but maybe just to – before we pivot away, what would this bill actually do?
This bill would create a process for – wherein there could be recognition of historical injustices and would create a mechanism for posthumous exoneration and annulment of convictions. And then that's part of the statute, and it will then goes on to annul the convictions and the punishment of Eunice Goody Cole and also Willard Uphouse. So it sets the historic record straight. You know, it's akin 5 years ago or 6 years ago. Again, we in the way of trying to find historical justice, the state legislature finally responded to the petition that had been sent to the legislature by a group of slaves from Portsmouth. And long after they were – that was never addressed. And so the legislature took it upon itself and the governor signed it to, you know, posthumously grant that freedom so that we could have kind of a reckoning
the
of what
record.
Took place.
Yeah.
It's something that's done in a number of places. Facing history is really important. And I think if we don't acknowledge things that we've done wrong in the past, we're bound to repeat them again.
Yes.
And in this particular time, when I look at what's happening with people who are, you know, marginalized, there's echoes of you know, Goody Cole in the way that we talk about immigrants
and prisoners.
There's
homeless.
There's echoes of what happened to Willard Uphouse when you talk about some of the treatment that people have and what dissent means and what resistance means and what principled activity means.
Yes, excellent point.
Great. All right. You are listening to State House Watch on WNHN LP 94.7 in Concord. I'm Arnie Alpert.
I'm Maggie Fogarty, and we're with State Representative Rennie Cushing.
Let's actually talk with Representative Cushing right now about some labor-related issues that you have sponsoring, one of which has to do with the fundamental human rights of university system employees, and another has to do with the fundamental human rights of employees of the state legislature.
Right. Well, in both of those, when it comes to university, a few years ago, the university system in New Hampshire decided it was going to spend $250,000 to break a union organizing drive. A couple hundred thousand dollars. And rather than treat their employees with dignity and respect, they decided they'd hire an outside contractor to come and help them defeat that organizing drive. And what the bill we've introduced that we'll have a hearing on Wednesday does is it recognizes that the right to form a union is it's part of the constitutional right we all have to associate, and it puts into statute that the university must recognize the right of people to associate, to form unions, and prohibits the spending of university dollars to thwart that exercise of the fundamental right to associate. There's another bill that passed the House a couple of weeks ago for the first time that extends the protections of the Public Employees Labor Relations Act to the one remaining group of public employees that did not enjoy that protection, and those would be the employees of the legislature itself. Every school district, every water district, every state highway department, every teacher, every university system itself enjoys the protections of the Public Employees Labor Relations Act, and this legislation will extend that to the own employees.
And not to spring a number question on you, but approximately how many individuals would that?
Probably about 150.
Okay, great. And you were one of those at one point.
Back in the day, I was a legislative employee.
Yeah.
Was there some amendment, Rennie, that was added that has to do with different treatment for what they're calling political appointees?
Well, there is I think in classic labor relations and public employees, we usually distinguish between management and unions. And yeah, there's a distinction between people who are part of the political process and people who are just
Their job.
That's their job. That's their job. Who would be, obviously someone who's works directly for the Speaker of the House is the example,
right.
Which is distinguished from people who are legislative, who are bill drafters, who are researchers,
or
who are working the maintenance
personnel,
crew,
right.
Security personnel, auditors in the budgets, secretarial staff,
right.
All of the people, to me, there should be no difference between the person or treatment who cleans the toilets for the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, cleans the toilets for the governor of the state of New Hampshire, and cleans the toilets for the Speaker and the President of the Senate. And this just simply recognizes that all employees are entitled to be treated with dignity and respect and exercise their right to associate.
Yeah, this has passed the House and it's on its way to the Senate.
It's on the way to the Senate, and I'm hopeful. Once upon a time, the legislature banned – or there was a prohibition against judicial branch employees, again, thinking that somehow if you let judicial and branch employees unionize, that would impact the quality of justice. But that's gone by the way. The only only group of public employees in the state that don't enjoy that protections are the employees of the legislature itself. Interesting, the legislature is willing to impose or offer that protection to everybody else except for their own employees.
Yeah. And so practically speaking, when this protection is extended to include the legislative staff, their next step would be to organize, to affiliate themselves with an existing public sector union or perhaps be their own.
They would, like every other public employee of the state, enjoy the right to association and to form into a bargaining unit if they want and to bargain collectively with their employees.
And then maybe we'll need legislation to bar the state from spending money on union-busting firms in this regard.
Yeah.
that may be an eventuality. I'll just say another piece of legislation I sponsored that has a hearing and relates to credit privacy and financial privacy. We live in a time where one should not surrender every aspect of their individual private lives just to their employer. Mm-hmm. And so this will prohibit someone from making an inquiry about, where you have a credit card, what your mortgage is, how bad was your divorce, mm-hmm. all of the things that are just really invasive that don't allow an employee to maintain their privacy and their dignity. It will be interesting to see how those who are think of New Hampshire as being kind of a live free or die state or an advocate of privacy will respond to this bill. Mm-hmm. It passed the legislature in the past. Unfortunately, Governor Sununu vetoed the bill last year. I think what's different is that the people of the state of New Hampshire last November passed an amendment to our Constitution that enshrined and recognized the right to privacy.
There's so many things going on right now that touch on these issues of privacy and where there's legislation trying, what is cyberbullying and do we have the right to wear masks in public and what is the role of facial recognition technology and all of these things which are coming up, some of which come into the purview of the Criminal Justice and Public Safety Committee. Let's take a musical break right now and then come back and continue our conversation with representatives.
Because there's a lot in that committee that
there's
we can dig through.
There's a lot that is in there. So let's stick with the theme of witchcraft right now. This is a tune about the death of Goody Nurse. It's from an album called Witches and War Whoops, Early New England Ballads Collected and Sung by John Allison.
They came upon her like a host and bade her speak and tell why she had sworn a wicked oath to serve the powers of hell. Speak up, speak up, they hoarsely cry. The minister did swear. He cursed her with a heavy curse no mortal man may bear. Thou hast bewitched us, cried they all, and carried her away. In chains of iron, day and night, in Salem jail she lay. Until at last the door stood wide, they led her then abroad. By many an old familiar place, her trembling footsteps trod. The women held their babes on high to see her passing there. She smelt the wild rose on the wind that bloweth everywhere. They scourged her onward up the hill, this poor old woman meek. She bravely faced the gallows tree, though she was faint and weak. They hanged this weary woman then, like any felon stout. Her white hairs on the cruel rope were scattered all about, and many knew her innocent of horrid charges made, and some they heard her final prayer, "Oh, Father, forgive," she said.
John Allison, The Death of Goody Nurse, from the Smithsonian Folkways album Witches and War Whoops Early New England Ballads. This is Statehouse Watch on WNHN LP 94.7 FM in Concord, WNHNFM.org.
And this is Statehouse Watch Radio, but I think you said that.
I said that.
And we're still in the studio with Representative Rennie Cushing with so much to talk about, even during that break. It's like, oh, there's a thousand things that we could be catching up on with you. There's a lot that happens in your committee, but then also in other committees that relate to issues of justice.
We noticed that you've got your name on 75 different bills this biennium, so we think that's a lot of things to keep track of.
Well, they're all important.
Yeah.
And then there's all the bills that are in your committee that you need to keep track of. Yep. So it's a lot of work that goes on.
It's about equity, you know.
Yeah.
That's right.
We work hard for that.
Yeah.
So one that caught our attention would it require or study the requirement for psych evals for law enforcement? Can you say what that is?
Yeah. It would require that before anyone else is, authorized and certified to become a member of law enforcement, that they have to undergo a psychological evaluation for that they're fit to walk the streets and carry a gun.
So it's at the initial point. It's not a periodic assessment that.
Well, it's at the initial point that also requires the subsequent ones. I was actually shocked to find out that we have a two-tier system of licensing for members of law enforcement. Most of the large cities require that applicants undergo a psychological examination, that they show that they're as competent to act as a law enforcement officer as they are as a marksman. And for me, this grew out in part because my father had been murdered 30 years ago by a member of law enforcement who, prior to being hired as a police officer, had served time in juvenile jail for armed robbery. He had been involved in weapons charges. And he was given the authority to go and walk the street, to patrol the streets without anyone taking much of a look into the background. Wow. And I knew that I knew that within the past couple decades there had been a requirement. What I didn't – that law enforcement before their they're certified as police officers had to undergo psychological training. But what I did not know is that it was voluntary. And based upon whether the individual whim of a community, if a community didn't want to pay the $500 to have a candidate to become a police officer pass a psychological test, then they weren't required to. So this will actually mandate that we have an expectation that someone who is patrolling the streets actually is qualified.
With
to
a
do
weapon.
So.
Great. Yeah. Rennie, what kind of reaction are you getting from the police organizations and lobbyists?
I think the police organizations are supportive of it. I think they are wary of the irresponsible member of law enforcement who, was able to wear a badge and patrol the streets without meeting, the basic levels for best practices in law enforcement. I was actually surprised at Primex that the municipal carriers, the insurers, didn't insist that some member of the community. Because if you have someone, it's just irresponsible, I believe, to authorize someone to, have a special privilege of using deadly force to take someone's freedom away from them, to surround them without having given the best effort to make sure that the person's competent and qualified.
Speaking of the use of deadly force, there's also legislation that would open up investigations of what are called officer-involved shootings.
Yeah, there's a bill in that will take a look at the current practices involving officer-involved shooting. There is a protocol that was established 16 years ago by the Attorney General's office that takes a look at what happens when an officer fires a gun. And there's just some concerns that get raised about what happens when that takes place. Is the current mechanism for responding to it adequate? Are there ways that we can improve that? There's concerns about making sure people are adequately trained so that they can respond to people with, recognized mental illness and be able to respond to that, that they can take steps to de-escalate a situation where it's appropriate. And so there's legislation that's before my committee that I think will
and be discussed. And there'll be a pun here, but unintended. The trigger for such an investigation would be the firing of any weapon or a person who's injured or killed?
It's right now it's whenever an officer is involved in a shooting. There is a mechanism that is in place that the state police conduct an investigation, even if it involves a member of the state police. So there's a number of discussions that are out there. Should there be a different component with a civilian oversight? Are there better ways to do it? Have we taken a look at the current practices and policies to see if they're adequate and serve the public need?
Oh, great.
I think it's a question of transparency and accountability.
Great. Mm-hmm. A lot of these stories, Rennie, seem to deal with this question of we're dealing with the authority that the state has to deprive people of life and liberty, and that has to do with the role of the police, but also the role of prisons. And at the moment, the role of the state psychiatric hospital, which is part of the prison system. So could you say a word about the current status of the secure psychiatric unit, which you've been really campaigning and about that for years now?
Well, we've talked about this before.
Yeah.
During the last legislative the last year, for the first time, the legislature actually made a commitment to build a facility to treat people who are with acute mental illness so that they're to the extent that they're a threat to either themselves or others. Right now, and it has been for the past 30 years, people who are of that situation are not able to stay at the state hospital, psychiatric hospital, so they get transferred and stuck inside the prison psych unit inside the walls of the state prison and treated in a prison setting as opposed to a therapeutic hospital setting. It's been a long battle. The legislature actually appropriated what they think is half the money is in the budget to construct a new psychiatric facility adjacent to the current state hospital. There's legislation that I've introduced that creates an advisory committee to make sure that that facility actually gets built and that the money just doesn't languish there, that it proceeds and goes forward with the engineering work, with the design work that you'd want to have there. So,
does your bill name who would populate that advisory committee?
Yes, it does. It includes people, National Alliance of Mental Illness, the Civil Liberties Union, representatives of patients, people with lived experience inside the SPU, representatives of the families of people who are currently in the secure psychiatric unit, along with the lead on it would be the Commissioner of Health and Human Services, but assisted by the Commissioner of Corrections. I will say I was glad that the legislation went before the Health and Human Services Committee as opposed to the Criminal Justice Committee, because the idea that we would be talking about mental health care in the Criminal Justice Committee just seems to be just
more of the same flawed understanding.
Right. Yeah. But we can note that as of last week, there is a new Commissioner of Health and Human Services who comes to that position from her previous position as the director of the state hospital for people with mental illness. So that could also mean that the department is now headed by someone who has relevant experience in this regard.
Have you had a chance to speak with her about this?
Oh, I've known her. I haven't talked to her about her direction, but I've worked with her in the past. I mean, I think for a long time there's been a recognition within the bureaucracy, within Health and Human Services, and with the Department of Corrections that the secure psychiatric unit housing people who've never been convicted of a crime but just simply are there because of their mental illness is not, you know, it's not less than ideal. It's really bad. But the responsibility ultimately really has laid with the legislature that has allowed this to take place. Mm-hmm.
Randy Cushing, another element of our justice system, not right now in the state, but is the growth of the for-profit prison industry, which we've seen around the country, particularly with regard to the incarceration of immigrants. But you've introduced a bill that would bar that practice in New Hampshire. So please tell us a little bit about that.
You know, I know, you know, 4 or 5 years ago, there was a lot, maybe 6 years ago, there was discussion about whether or not they should privatize the prison.
In 2011, actually, the state budget ordered the Department of Corrections to seek some private entity that would take over the entire department. So.
The whole department,
It was actually it was in the state budget.
You know, and I'm very mindful of the fact that our Constitution states really plainly that the true purpose of prison is to rehabilitate, not exterminate mankind. Mm. And I think that it is such an awesome exercise of the power of the state to take away someone's freedom that it ought not be anybody's profit center, that it that the people who are in charge of guarding, overlooking, and rehabilitating people who we deem need to be – have a serious time to being incarcerated, I want them to take an oath of office that pledges allegiance to uphold the Constitution of the state of New Hampshire and not whose primary purpose is to uphold the corporate profits of the stockholders of that. I think it's vile of public policy to think that you should make – it should be a profit-making endeavor to hold human beings in captivity. And I think that's it would be an important statement for New Hampshire to make sure that that doesn't take place.
And so your bill related to private prisons would do what?
It prohibits the privatization of prisons.
Okay, just simply put. Okay, very good.
Great, great, great. Let's actually switch away from – we've just got a few more minutes with Randy Cushing. So I want to drop the corrections issue for a moment and go to some other interests of yours, which seem to – touch on some private institutions in the state dealing with hunting and dealing with elite education. So what do those have in common?
Well, I don't know if they have in common. I think equity is really important and fairness is really important to me. And I think, for instance, there's a bill that I'm a co-sponsor that would require Dartmouth College, which operates cabins and rents cabins out in the Dartmouth College grant in a 10-square-mile area that the state of New Hampshire gave to Dartmouth a couple centuries ago, that it pay the rentals tax on those cabins just like everybody else who rents a cabin at Hampton Beach or Weirs Beach or someplace. Everybody should pay their own fair share.
What was the possible justification
for
them not?
It's educational purposes.
They claim – actually, though, they've acknowledged that they're subject to the tax, and the question is, they said they're going to start collecting it as January 1st. And my question is, well, you know, we've had a meals and rentals tax since 1967 in the state of New Hampshire, and I wonder if they're going to pay back the money that they owe the state money it collected. That's, you know, everybody has to pay their fair share of taxes, and when you have a $5 billion endowment, which is a lot more than the $100 million rainy day fund of the state of New Hampshire, Dartmouth should step up and pay its fair share.
Is not your first Dartmouth-related bill, though, because you've had your eye on them for some time?
Well, I think that the purpose of the second Dartmouth grant was to assist the education of indigent students in the state of New Hampshire.
And you have a long memory. When was that?
When it was –
the second Dartmouth grant?
In 1807.
1807. All right. Just checking.
It was
– well, it was when
they petitioned. They petitioned the state of – they were impoverished and they would not be able to survive, and they made their great promises and expectations on how they were going to help educate the people of the state of New Hampshire. In fact, they did that for a long time. Every year the legislature for decades – made an annual appropriation to Dartmouth College for the purpose of educating people in the state of New Hampshire. It was before there was a university system. Dartmouth made representations to it, so that was part of it. And now it's although it's Dartmouth serves more students from Europe than it does from the state of New Hampshire. So,
and was there? Can you pinpoint a period of shift, of change in their sense of their mission and their obligation to that initial purpose?
You know, going back in the 1920s when they used the proceeds of the sale of timber for the Dartmouth grant to renovate the house of the president of Dartmouth as opposed to providing scholarships for indigent students from New Hampshire to get a higher education, that would be a period. I think you know, it's complicated when you have an institution like that that had – you know, had close ties, was an integral part of it, and have always had people who've been, you know, provided a leadership role in certain aspects of the Dartmouth. It's been a unique institution and remains a unique institution.
Randy Cushing, speaking of unique institutions, 30 seconds on Corbin Park before we let you go.
The largest enclosed canned hunting reserve east of the Mississippi is here in New Hampshire, where people can go on safari and take exotic game that's within that 26-mile fenced-in area.
Can I do that?
You can't because you're not part of the elite people who have access to it.
Is it invitation only, especially
special sweetheart legislation. The one thing that you don't do when you go hunting there for wild boar and elk is you don't have to buy a hunting license, unlike everyone else who takes game here in the state of New Hampshire. So, when there's a hunting accident and someone shoots another hunter because they mistake them for a wild boar, or when the wild boar from get out and land on Interstate 89 and the Department of Fish and Game has to respond to both of those, the people who are enjoying the benefits of that don't buy a license to contribute to the Fish and Game
Department. Haven't invested in that.
Instead, it's the people, you know, who are paying their $30 to go get a license to dig a pail of clams. They're helping to subsidize the hunting expeditions of these safaris and New Hampshire.
Great. So in that way, it's quite similar to the Dartmouth issue, isn't it? It's like stop nickel and diming. Pay your fair share.
Pay your fair share. And public institutions, public servants, and private institutions need to be held accountable in some ways and not be committing abuses. Randy Cushing, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much. Always a joy.
Yeah. Next week, our guests will be Jeannie Ruska and Joseph Lascaz from the American Civil Liberties Union.
So we'll actually continue our conversations
about criminal justice and civil liberties and privacy with them. Join us again the week after that. We'll have the Executive Director of Energy New Hampshire talking about energy-related legislation in New Hampshire. Maggie, what else is coming up?
Can I just mention a special event this week on Wednesday, January 29th, in the evening at St. Augustine Catholic Church from 7 to 8 p.m. is now, I think it's the third year, a Holy Family Migrant Family prayer service, bringing people together to affirm the dignity of all refugees and immigrants. And today is the third anniversary of the Muslim ban, and a reminder that we have to be actively asserting the dignity and rights of all people. So
that's right. Great.
This is a way to do that.
Very good. And Thursday, the Uncaged Art exhibit at Jupiter Hall in Manchester continues. That's on Hanover Street.
Yeah, you were there last week.
I recommended that exhibit. This is art that was made by children who were being imprisoned down near the southern border, children from El Salvador and Guatemala. It seemed to be largely in Honduras. So I recommend that you go see that. And there will be a program there at 6 p.m. on Thursday evening where they'll be talking about issues of trauma. You've been listening to Statehouse Watch on WNHNLP. I'm Arnie Alpert.
I'm Maggie Fogarty.
I want to ask you to join us again next week. I want to thank you for listening. And special thanks to our engineer and producer, Fred Portnoy. And we say to Fred, happy birthday.
Happy birthday,
right.
Fred.
Go to our website, WNHNFM.org. Check out all the other shows, download podcasts, and hit that donate button to keep community radio on the air. Thanks for listening. We go out with Dave Brubeck.